Chapter 4. Free? Sander Jaunty met the other's eyes coldly. He said, "Gone, you say?" Rizzet passed a hand over his ruddy face.
"Something is gone. I don't know its identity. It might have been the document we're after, certainly. All we know about it is that it had been dated somewhere in the 15th to 21st century of Earth's primitive calendar, and that it is dangerous."
"Is there any definite reason to believe that the missing one is the document?"
"Only circumstantial reasoning. It was guarded closely by the Earth government."
"Discount that. An Earthman will treat any document relating to the pre-galactic past with veneration. It's their ridiculous worship of tradition."
"But this one was stolen, and yet they never announced the fact. Why do they guard an empty case?"
"I can imagine they're doing that rather than finding themselves forced to admit that a holy relic has been stolen. Yet I cannot believe that young Farrell obtained it after all. I thought you had him under observation." The other smiled.
"He didn't get it."
"How do you know?"
Jaunty's agent quickly exploded his landmine.
"Because the document has been gone 20 years.
"What?"
"It has not been seen for 20 years.
"Then it can't be the right one. It was less than 6 months ago that the rancher learned of its existence."
"Then somebody else beat him to it by 19.5 years.
Jaunty considered. He said, "It does not matter. It cannot matter."
"Why so?"
"Because I have been here on Earth for months. Before I came, it was easy to believe that there might be information of value on the planet. But consider now. When Earth was the only inhabited planet in the galaxy, it was a primitive place. Militarily speaking, the only weapon they had ever invented worth mentioning was a crude and inefficient nuclear reaction bomb, for which they had not even developed a logical defense." He flung his arm outward in a delicate gesture to where the blue horizon gleamed its sickly radioactivity beyond the thick concrete of the room. He went on. "All this is placed in sharp focus for me as a temporary resident here. It is ridiculous to assume that it is possible to learn anything from a society at that level of military technology. It is always very fashionable to assume that there are lost arts and lost sciences, and there are always these people who make a cult of primitivism, and who make all sorts of ridiculous claims for the prehistoric civilizations on Earth."
Rizzet said, "Yet the rancher was a wise man. He told us specifically that it was the most dangerous document he knew. You remember what he said. I can quote it. He said, 'The matter is death for the Tirani and death for us as well. But it would mean final life for the galaxy.'"
"The rancher, like all human beings, can be wrong."
"Consider, sir, that we have no idea as to the nature of the document. It could, for instance, be somebody's laboratory notes, which had never been published. It might be something that could relate to a weapon the Earthmen had never recognized as a weapon, something which on the face of it might not be a weapon."
"Nonsense. You are a military man and should know better. If there is one science into which man has probed continuously and successfully, it is that of military technology. No potential weapon would remain unrealized for 10,000 years. I think, Rizzet, we will return to Lingane."
Rizzet shrugged. He was not convinced.
Nor a thousandfold was Jaunty. It had been stolen, and that was significant. It had been worth stealing. Anyone in the galaxy might have it now. Unwillingly, the thought came to him that the Tirani might have it. The rancher had been most evasive on the matter. Even Jaunty himself had not been trusted sufficiently. The rancher had said it carried death. It could not be used without having it cut both ways. Jaunty's lips clamped shut. The fool and his idiotic hintings. And now the Tirani had him. What if a man like Aratap were now in the possession of such a secret as this might be? Aratap, the one man, now that the rancher was gone, who remained unpredictable, the most dangerous Tiranian of them all. Symok Aratap was a small man, a little bandy-legged, narrow-eyed fellow. He had the stumpy, thick-limbed appearance of the average Tiranian, yet though he faced an exceptionally large and well-muscled specimen of the subject worlds, he was completely self-possessed. He was the confident heir, in the second generation,
of those who had left their windy, infertile worlds and sparked across the emptiness to capture and enchain the rich and populous planets of the nebular regions. His father had headed a squadron of small flitting ships that had struck and vanished, then struck again and made scrap of the lumbering Titanic ships that had opposed them. The worlds of the nebula had fought in the old fashion, but the Tirani had learned a new one. Where the huge glittering vessels of the opposed navies attempted single combat, they found themselves flailing at emptiness and wasting their stores of energy. Instead, the Tirani, abandoning power alone, stressed speed and cooperation, so that the opposed kingdoms toppled one after another, singly, each waiting, half joyfully at the discomfiture of its neighbors, fallaciously secure behind its steel-shipped ramparts, until its own turn came. But those wars were 50 years earlier. Now the nebular regions were satrapies that required merely acts of occupation and taxation. Previously there had been worlds to gain, Aratap thought wearily, and now there was little left to do but to contend with single men. He looked at the young man who faced him. He was quite a young man, a tall fellow, with very good shoulders indeed, an absorbed, intent face, with the hair of his head cut ridiculously short in what was undoubtedly a collegiate affectation. In an unofficial sense, Aratap was sorry for him. He was obviously frightened. Byron did not recognize the feeling inside him as fright. If he had been asked to put a name to the emotion, he would have described it as tension. All his life he had known the Tirani to be the overlords. His father, strong and vital though he was, unquestioned on his own estate, respectfully heard on others, was quiet and almost humble in the presence of the Tirani. They came occasionally to Widimos on polite visits, with questions as to the annual tribute they called taxation. The rancher of Widimos was responsible for the collection and delivery of these funds on behalf of the planet Nephelos, and, perfunctorily, the Tirani would check his books. The rancher himself would assist them out of their small vessels. They would sit at the head of the table at mealtimes, and they would be served first. When they spoke, all other conversation stopped instantly. As a child, he wondered that such small, ugly men should be so carefully handled, but he learned as he grew up that they were to his father what his father was to a cowhand. He even learned to speak softly to them himself and to address them as Excellency. He had learned so well that now that he faced one of the overlords, one of the Tirani, he could feel himself shiver with tension. The ship which he had considered his prison became officially one on the day of landing upon Rhodia. They had signaled at his door, and two husky crewmen had entered and stood on either side of him. The captain, who followed, had said in a flat voice, "Byron Farrell, I take you into custody by the power vested in me as captain of this vessel, and hold you for questioning by the commissioner of the Great King." The commissioner was this small Tyranian who sat before him now, seemingly abstracted and uninterested. The Great King was the Khan of the Tirani, who still lived in the legendary stone palace on the Tyranian's home planet. Byron looked furtively about him. He was not physically constrained in any way, but four guards in the slate blue of the Tyranian outer police flanked him, two and two. They were armed. A fifth, with a major's insignia, sat beside the commissioner's desk. The commissioner spoke to him for the first time. "As you may know," his voice was high-pitched, thin, "the old rancher of Widimos, your father, has been executed for treason." His faded eyes were fixed on Byron's. There seemed nothing beyond mildness in them. Byron remained stolid. It bothered him that he could do nothing. It would have been so much more satisfying to howl at them, to flail madly at them, but that would not make his father less dead. He thought he knew the reason for this initial statement. It was intended to break him down, to make him give himself away. Well, it wouldn't. He said evenly, "I am Byron Mullane of Earth. If you are questioning my identity, I would like to communicate with the Terrestrial Consul,
Ah, yes, but we are at a purely informal stage just now. You are Byron Mullane, you say, of Earth, and yet...
Aratap indicated the papers before him.
There are letters here which were written by Widdemost to his son. There is a college registration receipt and tickets to commencement exercises made out to a Byron Farrell. They were found in your baggage.
Byron felt desperate, but he did not let it show. My baggage was searched illegally, so I deny that those can be admitted as evidence.
We are not in a court of law, Mr. Farrell or Mullane. How do you explain them?
If they were found in my baggage, they were placed there by someone else. The commissioner passed it by, and Byron felt amazed. His statement sounded so thin, so patently foolish, yet the commissioner did not remark upon them, but only tapped the black capsule with his forefinger.
And this introduction to the director of Rhodia, also not yours?
No, that is mine. Byron had planned that. The introduction did not mention his name. He said, "There is a plot to assassinate the director." He stopped, appalled. It sounded so completely unconvincing when he finally put the beginning of his carefully prepared speech into actual sound. Surely the commissioner was smiling cynically at him. But Aratap was not. He merely sighed a little and, with quick practice gestures, removed contact lenses from his eyes and placed them carefully in a glass of saline solution that stood on the desk before him. His naked eyeballs were a little watery. He said,
"And you know of it? Even back on Earth, 500 light years away, our own police here on Rhodia have not heard of it."
"The police are here. The plot is being developed on Earth."
"I see. And you are their agent. Or are you going to warn Henrik against them?"
"The latter, of course."
"Indeed. And why do you intend to warn him?"
"For the substantial reward which I expect to get." Aratap smiled.
"That at least rings true and lends a certain truthful gloss to your previous statements. What are the details of the plot you speak of?"
"That is for the director only." A momentary hesitation, then a shrug.
"Very well. The Tirani are not interested and do not concern themselves with local politics. We will arrange an interview between yourself and the director, and that will be our contribution to his safety. My men will hold you until your baggage can be collected, and then you will be free to go. Remove him."
The last was to the armed men, who left with Byron. Aratap replaced his contact lenses, an action which removed instantly that look of vague incompetence their absence had seemed to induce. He said to the major, who had remained,
"We will keep an eye, I think, on this young Farrell."
The officer nodded shortly. "Good. For a moment I thought you might have been taken in. To me his story was quite incoherent."
"It was. It's just that which makes him maneuverable for the while. All young fools who get their notions of interstellar intrigue from the video spy thrillers are easily handled. He is, of course, the son of the ex-rancher."
And now the major hesitated. "Are you sure? It's a vague and unsatisfactory accusation we have against him."
"You mean that it might be arranged evidence after all? For what purpose?"
"It could mean that he is a decoy, sacrificed to divert our attention from a real Byron Farrell elsewhere."
"No. Improbably theatrical, that. Besides, we have a photo cube."
"What, of the boy?"
"Of the rancher's son. Would you like to see it?"
"I certainly would." Aratap lifted the paperweight upon his desk. It was a simple glass cube, 3 inches on each side, black and opaque. He said,
"I meant to confront him with it if it had seemed best. It is a cute process, this one, Major. I don't know if you're acquainted with it. It's been developed recently among the inner world. Outwardly, it seems an ordinary photo cube, but when it is turned upside down, there's an automatic molecular rearrangement which renders it totally opaque. It is a pleasant conceit."
He turned the cube right side up. The opacity shimmered for a moment, then cleared slowly like a black fog wisping and feathering before the wind.
Aratap watched it calmly, hands folded across his chest. And then it was water clear, and a young face smiled brightly out of it, accurate and alive, trapped and solidified in mid-breath forever.
"An item," said Aratap, "in the ex-rancher's possessions. What do you think?"
"It is the young man, without question."
"Yes."
The Turanian official regarded the photocube thoughtfully.
"You know, using the same process, I don't see why 6 photographs could not be taken in the same cube. It has 6 faces, and by resting the cube on each of them in turn, a series of new molecular orientations might be induced. 6 connected photographs flowing one into another as you turn. A static phenomenon turned dynamic and taking on new breadth and vision. Major, it would be a new art form."
A mounting enthusiasm had crept into his voice. But the silent major looked faintly scornful, and Aratap left his artistic reflections to say abruptly,
"Then you will watch Farrell."
"Certainly."
"Watch Henrik as well."
"Henrik?"
"Of course. It is the whole purpose of freeing the boy. I want some questions answered. Why is Farrell seeking Henrik? What is the connection between them? The dead rancher did not play a lone hand. There was, there must have been, a well-organized conspiracy behind them, and we have not yet located the workings of that conspiracy."
"But surely Henrik could not be involved. He lacks the intelligence, even if he had the courage."
"Granted. But it is just because he is half an idiot that he may serve them as a tool. If so, he represents a weakness in our scheme of things. We obviously cannot afford to neglect the possibility."
He gestured absently. The major saluted, turned on his heel, and left. Aratap sighed, thoughtfully turned the photo cube in his hand, and watched the blackness wash back like a tide of ink. Life was simpler in his father's time. To smash a planet had a cruel grandeur about it, while this careful maneuvering of an ignorant young man was simply cruel. And yet, necessary.